When we think about art in New York in the early 20th century, what's likely to come to mind is the gritty realism of the Ashcan School or how European modernism shocked so many people at the Armory Show. But most New Yorkers of the time were more likely to contemplate the decorative arts of the city streets than the latest painting trends. You still may come across a tenement building adorned by an angel or a gargoyle, but many of those carvings would have been lost forever if not for the foresight and clandestine salvage efforts of Ivan Karp, who later donated most of his collection to the Brooklyn Museum. Unfortunately, this architectural patrimony is being threatened once again. In the current issue of The Atlantic, John Freeman Gill's piece, Ghosts of New York, investigates what has become of these remnants of our forgotten streetscapes. It's part of a special report on the future of this city. And John Freeman Gill joins us now, along with Ivan Karp. Welcome to our show. Well, Ivan, welcome back.
Nice to be here with you.
Now, how early in your art career did you start collecting pieces of old tenement buildings? Were you an art critic in the Village Voice? Or?
I started before I had an art career,
really?
As you describe it. I was an unemployed Army veteran, and I had no clear destination. And I used to wander the streets in quest of inspiration.
Taking pictures?
Well, I did photographs also, yes, usually, but the older districts of the city, Brooklyn waterfront and lower Manhattan, the Lower East Side, and the very elaborately textured residential districts.
So when did you start collecting these carvings off of buildings?
The word collecting doesn't apply to my early labors. I found by chance where a building was being demolished a terracotta cherub's head lying on the ground, and I looked around and up at the building and saw that there were many other carvings on the building and castings. And I realized that these were being just carelessly dropped and not respected as having any aesthetic character. I carried that one home, and that was an inspiration to me to pursue the attempted salvage of other sculptural ornaments from the buildings being demolished, and that was during the 1950s.
And were you the only person you know who was even interested in these things?
I was the only one I had ever met who showed any interest in these carvings and the possibility that they were of certain merit.
Do you see your life as being something of a talent scout? I mean, later you were a talent scout for the Leo Castelli Gallery, and then you opened up your own gallery and introduced any number of artists to the art world.
I didn't pursue the career as a talent scout. My interest was in the visual experience. And it came about that I found my place in an art gallery where I could attempt to identify artists of consequence. Very gratifying experience when it comes to fruition.
John, we usually think of tenements as squalid, but many of these carvings now suggest a kind of luxury. Why did builders at the time consider these details worth the expense?
I think there was a feeling that for not very much money, you could give a feeling of sumptuousness to the surface sumptuousness to buildings that were, that might be quite humble and even squalid on the inside. So that it was the Victorian passion for adornment, that even a simple building could have some grandness, some grandeur to it.
And who created these works of art? Immigrants?
Yeah, by and large, they were done by immigrant craftsmen, mostly from the British Isles, joined also by Germans and Italians. And, you know, many of them, this isn't mentioned in the story, many of them died. They rarely made it past age 40. They would die of a respiratory illness called silicosis from inhaling the dust that they, you know, was created by the work that they left for the rest of us to enjoy.
They're mostly molding? Were they mostly carving, or were they working from molds?
The terracotta was done in modeling shops and then cast, but primarily brownstone, also limestone. Carvings were done often in situ by immigrant carvers, really incising their imaginations on the streetscape for the rest of us.
And they were working anonymously in the way that medieval craftsmen worked in Europe, weren't they?
That's exactly right. In fact, I got a wonderful email out of the blue, this nice thing about the modern era, from a fellow who calls himself an immigrant craftsman. After reading the article, he said he was sorry about what was happening to these particular artifacts, but that we immigrant anonymous artisans never expect to be recognized.
Ivan, was there something appealing to you about the anonymity of the artists behind the carvings?
No. I constantly sought some kinds of inscriptions on the stones as to who could have been possibly involved in some of the more remarkable carvings. Yesterday, I was looking at the collection we have here in the small upstate museum that we put together, and I saw the only word I found so far on a stone says top, which indicated where the piece was supposed to be located in the building. Occasionally, there's a numerical system that you could follow in sequence. If you were doing the demolition work, you could see numbered pieces, but never found the name on any of them.
How many of these pieces did you eventually accumulate?
Well, it's probably over 1,000. I think it could be close to 1,200-1,500 pieces, reasonably intact. We picked up pieces of ornament as well, hoping that eventually they could be conjoined.
And were you putting them in some kind of storage space?
Well, we tried to, among those who were helping me, two of the young men who worked with me on this attempted amalgamation of treasure, had backyards in their houses in Brooklyn. And that's where we storaged the first works that we saved. Then it became too much for them and for their families to deal with. And I had to seek about to locate another storage facility. And finally came to meet with Tom Buechner, the then director of the Brooklyn Museum. And he told me that they had a storage area for equipage, museum equipage, at the back that was not being used, and that I could bring and put the salvaged sculptures in that zone.
Was this before you had your own gallery, O.K. Harris Fine Arts?
Oh, it's long before that. I worked at other galleries before I had my own gallery opened in 1969.
Well, couldn't you have shown these in a gallery and tried to sell some of them?
Never did that.
Because pop art was around at the time, and I would have thought that these would have had a certain appeal.
Well, there was appeal. There were two or three, what you might call explorers in the city, who offered the works for sale and opened stores where sculpture like what we attempted to salvage was being offered for sale.
Now, the Brooklyn Museum displayed these, John, with great fanfare initially.
Yes.
What's happened in the year since?
Well, they were displayed from 1966 to 2000, and then at that point, it's 10 years ago this month, the museum dismantled almost all of the collection because they were doing some renovation work on their rear entrance. And ever since, there's a sort of fenced refugee camp behind the Brooklyn Museum parking lot, and there's 275 of these relics of New York's lost streetscape, and they've been sitting back there unsheltered, literally gathering moss, biological growth. Their faces are turned to the heavens, and water pools in them, in their eyeballs, and in the winter the water freezes. They're not being terribly well taken care of.
Well, that would suggest that the museum doesn't really value them very much.
That seems to be the issue at this point. It's very disheartening to see all these works so cavalierly storaged in a grassy area where they can't be seen, and just overgrowth in the area, and the pieces are cracking, falling apart, and they're going to be no more what they were.
Well, I'm sure you've spoken to them, Ivan. What have they told you? You gave them this very generous gift.
I was very amiable with Mr. Lehman when he first took office there, and I've not heard from him recently at all. I've written some letters asking about the destiny of these objects. I've not received recently any replies whatsoever. He may not have any respect for these objects as worthy of being kept in a museum setting. That's possibly the case.
John, you quote Thomas, what's his, Buechner?
Buechner,
the former director of the Brooklyn Museum, has said in 1966, "Our city is being extruded, rolled out, and poured into blank-faced forms. We live in the time of the clean line, the metaphysical proportion, the very, very empty space." He was saying that this was something from an earlier time when we had a different attitude, and it was better. Wasn't it?
I'm not sure he would have made that. Yeah, I guess you could say that's implicit in his.
Many people decried the cleaning off of buildings in Manhattan, for example, in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
Louis Sullivan building on Bleecker Street had much of its decoration removed at one point. You would have thought they would have respected that building.
It's funny you should say that because Ivan rescued several pieces of terracotta from that facade, and they are in the Brooklyn Museum collection as we speak.
It is kind of stunning, Ivan, that they would have desecrated a Louis Sullivan building. He's one of the greatest architects of all time.
Yeah, I think that it's possible that in the instance of Mr. Lehman's casual response to the materials in the garden, that maybe he felt that they were too easily acquired. that they didn't go through the stress and travail of gallery of museum acquisition and the cost of it. This was there, easy to get for me, wandering around the streets at night picking up old stones. It didn't have, maybe in a sense, any value to him.
Although Buechner, when I spoke to Buechner recently, the museum director at the time when the museum sculpture garden was inaugurated, I said, well, what these things were taken off buildings. Why did you think they were worthy of a permanent exhibition at a major museum? And he said, well, you might as well ask me why I think Rembrandt is a good painter.
My guest, John Freeman Gill, who's written a piece called Ghosts of New York for the current issue of Atlantic as part of their series called The Future of the City. Also with us is Ivan Karp, the critic and gallery owner who collected all of these pieces that were put in the museum. Is this a matter of what the museum world would call de-ascensioning?
Yes. De-ascensioning, one of the most treacherous terms ever used in common parlance. De-accession to reverse the taking in of an important object. No way of saying we're getting rid of it.
Yeah, de-accession is it.
Well, in some cases, museums that are strapped for cash have sold off pieces they considered less important to be able to.
Especially the Brooklyn Museum has always had difficult financial stress. And I can appreciate that necessity for parting with some of the fragments and pieces of modest quality that I brought to the museum. Maybe some could have been offered to other institutions or even somehow put away for final resting.
And John, your article mentions that some of these pieces have been sold to a foundation in St. Louis.
No, they were not sold. Those pieces were transferred to a nonprofit building arts foundation.
So they're just given away.
Those were just given away.
Carted off.
Yeah, and that's those were very large pieces that perhaps the museum couldn't have installed. But I think the main issue right now is the pieces that that they have deaccessioned, but they have not yet transferred. And that is they fully intend to transfer to auction off to the highest bidder 1/3 of their remaining collection of New York City architectural artifacts.
Now, Ivan, when you donate art to a museum, isn't some kind of a contract written?
Would you have control
over whether they can just get rid of it?
During the first years of my involvement in the salvage operation, I had no notion of how this kind of thing functioned. And there's no documentation as to my gift or the value of the gift or the opportunity for tax exemption as a result of the gift. So there's no documentation whatsoever to indicate that I gave the works or that the museum owns them.
John, you ended up playing an active part in the story when you told Ivan that the Brooklyn Museum was planning to auction off some of the pieces.
That's right.
What was that moment like?
Well, you try to be an objective journalist, but it was heartbreaking, to be honest, because Ivan had shown me some of the pieces in his jewel box of a museum up in Charlottesville several months before. And Ivan is an 83-year-old man. This is his life's work. And he was full of vibrance and vigor and pride, really, at the work he had done in saving New York City's architectural patrimony. And so when I told him that 1/3 of this collection was being sold off at auction to the highest bidder and scattered around the world, he literally sort of shrunk before my eyes. He looked old, and since then, I'm sure you've recovered, Ivan. But
I feel pretty good right now.
Well, what were you thinking when he told you that? Were you shocked?
Disbelief is the only thing I could say, that they would do that, because it's necessary to do that. And if they could have at least consulted with me, I was an art dealer, I might have found a better path for their regenerating the garden, or finding some method of raising funds specifically for the purpose of reconstituting the garden.
Well, we have posted a slideshow of some of the stone carvings on our show page at WNYC.org to give our listeners a sense of what we're talking about.
Oh, that's just wonderful. I'm so pleased, because a lot of people are really just not aware of how rich and complex the ornamentation of these buildings is.
But have you been aware of the way some of these pieces have been displayed in recent years, allowed to be destroyed by the elements?
One of the significant destinations of our life, my wife and I, we go to the Brooklyn Museum. Now it's such a disheartening thing to have occurred that I missed the last two or three shows, which ordinarily I would have been delighted to see. I just couldn't go to the backyard and see what became of the installation.
John, there was an article in the New York Times last week about how people are rediscovering the appeal of the white brick buildings of the 50s and 60s. And someone quoted in the article said it was important to remember that you live inside the house, not outside. Is that perspective completely different from how people might have thought of architecture 100 years ago?
I think it's very different. I talked to David Garrard Lowe, who's a great architectural historian. He said of these works in the Brooklyn Museum collection, he said that this was really an attempt to enhance and beautify the street for the ordinary person, and that's something very important. It's something we've lost, he felt.
Well, today,
I can't sense the consciousness of the architects of the period, the people, those who were hired to construct the tenement buildings, which were adorned with sculpture, that they had an elevated purpose in doing that. And I think it was meant to, in some ways, maybe even deceive a possible tenant into believing that these buildings had a certain majesty, a certain aesthetic presence.
Well, they sure were fun to look at as you walk down the street. In some cases, some of them were quite wonderful and look like art, as you know, not just decoration, but they really look like art. John, this is a story about a part of New York's history, but it's in a section of the Atlantic called The Future of the City. Some irony there?
I suppose there is. I suppose, you know, I'm not the editor. I didn't put it in this section. But I think the notion is that whether it was inadvertent or intentional, the turn of the last century, the artisans who put their hands to these stones and to the terracotta were creating a vibrant public art gallery for everybody. And I think there's a sense that that's not likely to happen today.
The first designation for the Anonymous Arts Recovery Society was rubble without applause.
Well, how important do you think it is, Ivan, to the future of New York City that we preserve our past?
I mean, there are different sensibilities at work. There are some people who pay no attention whatsoever to the ornamental systems on buildings, and others who are impassioned. From the response I've had to the article in the Atlantic magazine, this is a groundswell of sudden passionate involvement with the fabric of the old city and the need to keep some kind of memory of it.
And, John, have you heard anything from the Brooklyn Museum since the article was published?
I have not. They issued a sort of tepid statement saying that they seem to be backpedaling from the notion that they, not that they were planning to deaccession these items, but that they were going to auction them through Evan Blum, the Harlem salvage dealer. But they did tell me in writing that the top curator, American art curator at the Brooklyn Museum, told me in writing that they have 650 pieces of this architectural fragment collection, and they planned at auction to sell 223 of them through the auction dealer, through the salvage dealer, Evan Blum.
And we have no idea what would happen with them, because the listener wants to know if there's any chance that the pieces could be permanently displayed somewhere else.
Well, that's the question, isn't it? It would be best.
We've given examples of these carvings to various institutions around New York State, to the New York State Museum in Albany, to the Museum of the City of New York, and to other institutions. We're delighted to receive examples of these objects. And we could have arranged to have giving of examples of the works to various other institutions.
Thank you both so much for being with us, Ivan Karp.
Thank you so much for taking interest in this valuable subject.
And John Freeman Gill, whose article, Ghosts of New York, is in the special section of the Atlantic called The Future of the City. It's been a pleasure talking with both of you, and I'm really horrified by the story, unfortunately.
It's a pleasure, Leonard. Thank you.